there's a lot of things to watch for, and some people are more in the now. I want to make a fee now. I got to get this money out now. My wife wants that new lake house. Got to get it out, right? And greed drives bad decisions.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Birmingham Real Estate Investor. I am one of your hosts, Spencer Sutton. We've got Matthew Whitaker as my co-host here, and we're excited to have David Oakley with us today. And David is the founder of OG Capital, and he's senior managing director of Berkadia. So, man, David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me. I'm glad you guys are doing this. It's interesting in the world that we're living in right now. You know, we have a lot of questions in our space. You know, what do we invest in? What should we do right now? How's COVID affecting our industry? Where are the needs? Where are the opportunities? So I think it's a good time to sort of bring this content to people, and I'm happy to jump on.
Yeah, well, we appreciate you doing it, David. Yeah. You and I have known each other for probably 10 years, and we've run into each other a few different times, but I would love for you to tell our audience how you got into real estate. Why real estate? Because you've been doing it a long time, even though you're a young guy like us.
Yeah, I'll be 40 in January. So it's I still feel young, but...
you guys are young, actually.
That number in my head, that crossover is kind of bothering me a little bit. But yeah, I was fortunate to get into the space early in my life. I went to Samford and studied accounting, really not knowing what I wanted to do. And the only reason I chose accounting was because my high school girlfriend's father was a CPA. So it seemed like the right choice at the time. I'm glad I did it. Did a lot of internships through the years. And my mother was a school teacher. My father was an electrician. And I knew I didn't want to do either of those. So I was like, all right, what do I do? And my first introduction to real estate was really owning a lawn company in high school. And I cut some yards for some guys who own investment homes. And I kind of asked the question like, you know, why do you guys own this? How does this work? And I understood, you know, the rental program, paying down principal, and that cash flow started making a lot of sense to me. Fast forward to Samford, studied accounting, was a resident assistant on campus. So that was my first sort of introduction into managing residents, managing tenants in the Sigma New House, which was good and bad because I wanted to be liked. And I was having to hit people up with damages when they moved out, you know, after every semester. But got an internship at Harbert Realty Services back in the summer of 2000. We'll say it had been fall 2002. No, it was summer. It was a summer internship. But I continued to work through the fall and spring. So I was, a sophomore or junior in college and just worked down the street at Harbert and was fortunate to work with the investment real estate side of the business. And my mentor who hired me was an old Trammell Crow guy. So he kind of brought some new education and light, shed some real light on the multifamily apartment side. And we really just focused on multifamily. So I was educated in multifamily, you know, when I was 19, 20 years old, loved it, and decided to make a career out of it.
Now, did you become a broker or an investor first?
Definitely a broker because I had no money.
Okay. And, well, tell us about that. So you become a broker, and then who did you work with? Did you work with this mentor?
So I worked with Harbert. I did the internship, did a short stint at PricewaterhouseCooper after I graduated in May of 2003 and worked summer at PricewaterhouseCooper. Knew that that was not for me, missed my real estate team and missed that office. They launched a new company in the fall of 2003 called Rock Apartment Advisors. And I went and interviewed with Rock and was hired as a full-time employee there at Rock the fall of 2003. So really got to see a new startup, new company from ground up. That was great just to learn how to build a business, one. And I started brokering, you know, so I got my license, started selling multifamily deals, four units, eight units, 20. I'll never forget selling the Berkeley on Highland just over my shoulder here. I'm here in Five Point South right now. And I felt like I was selling Trump Tower, you know, it's a $3 million deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Fell apart three times before the fourth buyer bought the deal. And I still talked to that owner, and that was some 20 years ago. So that's, I got in there with Rock and I brokered, and I always asked the question when we'd have out of town people come into town, because we would have mostly out of state investors come through Washington, maybe retired Boeing employees with money set aside to pull out and invest, California, Las Vegas. We had a direct connection to investors through some strategic alliances, and those folks would come into town. We'd basically be a glorified tour guide and mix in real estate. And we sold several deals that way. I cut my teeth on the south side. So it's about 10,000 units from I-65 to Avondale, now about 12, it's grown. And I was very active in this, you know, four units up to, you know, 60 unit kind of range with no on-site management, third-party management, located typically in office buildings. And that's really where I cut my teeth, and I sold a lot of the deals down here.
And you said that these people who were buying them, maybe retirees, did you ever come across like young professionals? Like what was the, and were they doing this in partnerships or were they individual buyers? How did these people put these deals together that were buying your?
Early on when we were doing more smaller properties that later grew into larger communities, it was more, you know, retirees or working people who were looking for cash flow, who wanted to diversify their retirement accounts or create some additional oxygen, is what I call it. I call cash flow oxygen. Everybody thinks better and makes better decisions when you have more oxygen in the tank. So it really was more smaller investors that maybe had $100,000 to $500,000, maybe $1 million, and that they may partner together and join resources with family and friends and purchase a property. Gotcha. So that's where we started. And then that grew over time. 2003 is when I started. By 2004 or five, I was selling, you know, $20 million deals, $30 million deals that were requiring more of a sometimes $20 million equity checks if we got into the, you know, $60 to $80 million deals. Yeah. So it just kind of grew. And what I learned, despite my fears, is that selling a 1,000-unit community is just the same as selling a 10-unit community. The process is the same. The type of person you're dealing with obviously is a little bit different, but, you know, we can sit down and have a hamburger or a Budweiser beer with people from all walks of life, you know, and it's just a process. I enjoy working with from the private capital side all the way up to the institutions. So it's a truly, it's a people business. And, I've really enjoyed that part of it. I love real estate and I love people, and I like to make a little money too, so that doesn't hurt. And I was very fortunate at an early age to meet my career bride. Like, I fell in love with multifamily. I fell in love with this industry.
Yeah, what I think is interesting is your career projection, or kind of the way it projects, also is very similar to how investors do it, right? Like, we all start out on the small deals and we eventually progress up to bigger and bigger deals. So talk about the types of deals you do today. And then I'd love to go back to kind of day one and tell me about your first deal.
Sure. So as Spencer mentioned earlier, two companies currently. One is Berkadia, and Berkadia is a national company. We have just right at 278 either investment sales guys like me, brokers for layman's terms, and then on the other side of the table, we have mortgage bankers. So we have the investment sales guys who push and market and find listings, and then we have the mortgage bankers who come in and assist with buyers and their partners in securing equity and debt. So it's a nice marriage, and that's why you've seen most of the large brokerage firms go that direction, whether it be CB Richard Ellis, HFF, etc. The other company that I'm involved with is called OG Capital, and you know, from an early age, I would always ask the investors who would come through as a broker, I would always ask them before they would leave, you know, how did you get started? Why are you doing this? Like, how does a guy like me with no money get on the equity side? Like, how do I get in? And I would always get great feedback. People want to help you. That's one thing you'll find in this business is that people, if you have the desire and hunger and you express that, like, people will come out of the woodworks to help you. I don't think that's just a, maybe it's just a Southern thing. I don't know. But I think generally people want to see people succeed. So I started buying property as a young broker, and I've continued to buy property under this name, OG Capital. And we have a team of about five, from chief operating officer to analyst to marketing, et cetera. And I, over that period of time, from I bought my first property when I was 22, 8 units in Eastlake. And I'll tell you about that story in a minute. But, you know, since then, over time, I've cobbled together about 1,200 units. And I have units from Chattanooga, Tennessee, down to Mobile. And we have our first development under construction currently in Huntsville, Alabama. It's a $60 million ground-up deal, 275 units, more of a cottage-style product on one parcel, but all rental. So effectively, it's an apartment deal. So it'll qualify for agency financing, Life Co., et cetera. So it has all the advantages of the debt markets that are available to us today. And we have two other sites under contract. So OG Capital is really in the business of buying existing product, value adding it, fixing it up, value engineering it, putting in staff, branding, et cetera. And second bucket is development. So I have the Berkadia side on brokerage, and I have the buy side with an ownership side with OG Capital. You can call it insider trading, but there's a very strong wall in between that says integrity standards and arm's length that we follow very closely. And that's worked well in our favor. I think I'm actually a better broker because I am an owner. I understand what it costs to change a toilet flap or, you know, deal with a manager who has to take extended leave or whatever. It's every property is like a business.
Yeah, this is one of the things that I always tell new people is, like, don't quit your day job. You need to have a job that, you know, you're fortunate, I'm fortunate, and Spencer's fortunate that we can have a day job in real estate. But we also invest on the side, right? And so you don't want to be immediately, everybody wants to quit, become a real estate investor, and immediately start living off their cash flow. And that's just not a wise thing to do. And so you, even at the top of your game, still have a day job that, you know, pays for your lifestyle, which allows you to invest totally passively.
Exactly. You know, I keep my day job. It pays the mortgages. It's you know, I've got a 16-month-old son at home, and that's not cheap. And so it's nice to have. It's nice to earn fees. It's nice to have a paycheck, and it's also nice to have the insight and the knowledge. With Berkadia, we have tremendous insight to deals happening all across the country. And that's with better information, you can make better financial decisions, which has boded well for us.
Well, tell us about your first deal. You said you bought an 8-unit in Eastlake. So how did that go?
And do you still own it?
Caveat to that, the very first deal that I bought was my house in Homewood. And I had renters with me in an apartment property down in Highland Park, just here near UAB. And I found this house on Green Springs Avenue with a for sale by owner sign in front of it. And I called the old lady and I hit it off. I went and visited with her. And then I talked to my banker at NBC Bank. That was a new relationship. I just had a referral down to Jim Beatty at NBC Bank, who's now with Capstone, and we're doing this deal in Huntsville together. So you never know where relationships will cross again. And I got 103% loan to value on that house back in 2003 or 2004.
Those are the good old days. That's right. Right.
And I couldn't believe that somebody's willing to give me 103% that I actually closing costs, everything paid for. And so that house had a basement, an unfinished basement. And in 6 months, I had my cousin, who's a mortgage broker, give me a home equity line of credit because the value had gone up, because I've been to Lowe's on every Saturday, done some work. Got a HELOC on the house, and a good friend of mine, Dr. Callahan at the Callahan Eye Foundation, called me and said, David, we just got this 8-unit deal in Eastlake donated to the foundation, and I don't want it. We're not going to run apartments out of the foundation. Can you find somebody to sell it through the brokerage? You know, he knew I was a broker. And I said, yeah, I can, but I'm interested to know, like, what do you want for it? He's like, I don't know. You know, it's just a donation, you know, like, and I was like, would you mind if I bought it? And he's like, I don't care. That'd be awesome. In fact, I'd love to buy it. So I got turned down by 3 or 4 banks. I had very little money, and had a banker friend say yes at the old Red Mountain Bank. And shout out to David Sizemore. And I bought that deal, learned a lot, hired some unqualified people, saw drug deals happening in the back parking lot, in the front parking lot, got calls from my third-party manager that I had residents under their beds and bullets were flying over their heads. So I learned a lot about that deal. I named it the Oaks of Eastlake. And I had it for about a year. It was 8 units, all 2-bedroom, 1 baths, hardwood floors. And I sold it about a year later to a guy who actually was in the house flipping business, who was trying to grow into some smaller multi to sort of step up into the multifamily sector. And I think I made $50,000. I was happy and glad to get it done. And I learned a lot. So that was my first kind of apartment deal.
Talk about some mistakes you see new investors make. You know, we were all a new investor at some point. And if somebody's a new investor and listening to this, what are some kind of pitfalls you can help them avoid?
Man, first of all, trust and partner with the right people, whether it be your third-party manager or who you're listening to. A lot of brokers out there will tell you anything to get the sale done, and it's important to really have a relationship and trust those people who you're putting your money with, whether it be your third-party manager, the broker you're talking to, etc. Number two, fully vet the underwriting. I see a lot of new investors flying here and think they know, they understand the expenses, or think that if they spend $5,000, they're going to get a $50 to $100 rent bump. Just really important to have someone on your team, whether it be a third-party manager adds a lot of value, because they'll do a budget for you on that property typically. And then you can vet their budget, compare your numbers to their budget. Maybe you get 2 third-party managers to give you a budget. If there's a discrepancy, ask why. Commonly missed expense line items are tax adjustment. A lot of people miss that. And every municipality, every district can be different, and it's easy to miss that. Second one is insurance. Be sure to get the loss runs and run. Get a quote early on the insurance, because currently insurance is skyrocketing, and it's a big, uh-oh, I missed that. That's happening pretty frequently right now. So know your underwriting. Talk to banks early. Know what they can and can't do. Because if you make some assumptions, especially in times like right now, in uncertain times when loan to values or, you know, interest rates or floaters or treasury, what all this stuff's moving, it's important for you to stay in touch early with your banker and often with your banker, because if they offer you, say, 80% week 1 and you're into week 4 of your contract, and all of a sudden they're filling their board meets and they say, you know, really, we're going to need to pull that down to 70%. All of a sudden your cash on cash yield has changed dramatically. So I'd say starting early on getting your bids, knowing your numbers, and staying close to the finance side of it is very important.
So we've talked, can I follow up with we've talked new investors. You work now with a lot of seasoned investors. I mean, some really sophisticated people. So I'm curious, and we haven't asked this before, but what do you see sophisticated investors? Where do they make mistakes?
Sophisticated investors make mistakes in a couple of areas. There's a lot of equity out there to get out. And so you have a financial system that has tremendous amount of equity sitting on the sidelines and looking for a home. And you have these sponsors, operators, who will go raise the funds or tag up with pension funds. And if they don't get the money out, they're going to go, those pension funds and those money owners will go down the road, down the hall, and they'll put the money with someone else. So there's this pressure to get the money out. And by the way, whenever a lot of these funds, whenever they give you a commitment, you're paying a pref return on that immediately. So the clock's ticking. That pressure, unfortunately, creeps into the mind of the decision makers, and you can make bad decisions. And so sometimes I see big money managers buy things and miss important parts of the underwriting because they're going so fast, because they really want the deal to work. They may turn a blind eye or look to the side and you know, really buy more into their pro forma or push their pro forma too hard, which the pro forma may work on a 10-year term deal, locking a rate right now with Fannie or Freddie at 2.8%, a 5% interest only loan. But what happens if you buy that deal for a 4.5 cap or a 5 cap? What happens in 10 years when that property is more run down and interest rates are at 5%? How does that affect the value? Has your NOI outpaced the interest rate environment? Because really, it's always a race between your NOI and cap rates. And cap rates trend off of interest rates. So there's a lot of things to watch for. And some people are more in the now. I want to make a fee now. I got to get this money out now. My wife wants that new lake house. Got to get it out, right? And greed drives bad decisions. Yeah. So as we get into bigger companies that have so much money and more commas and zeros, you would think that they would be more sophisticated, but sophistication doesn't always equal higher yield. And it can also mean mistakes. So
I had a question here, David. You know, you mentioned that when you were learning the business, one of the things you did was you just started getting with people, asking them questions. And you said people are very forthright and would love to, you know, they'd love to help people. What was the best advice you got as you were learning the ropes about getting into multifamily?
Good question. Everyone said, and I would talk to guys from San Diego, Seattle, New York, and the resounding answer was, buy now. Buy now. Don't wait a day later. Get in the deal flow now, because when 10 years goes by like this, and when that amortization is paying down your mortgage in 10 years, 20 years, you look up and you're like, okay, I've got real equity. And that was the best advice I got. And even, you know, in my superiors at Rock, they didn't like me buying, because if I bought, everybody else in the company wanted to buy, which took my eye off of production. I was a W-2 employee. And that was the reason why I left to start my own company in January of 2007, the Oakley Group, Inc., which later became a Berkadia company, still wholly owned by me. I'm a subcontractor. But that's when I had to make the decision, okay, nothing can keep me from my passion and my goal, and I want to be an owner. And it was a hard move to make. I was nervous. I was scared. I was 25. And I hung a shingle down here in Five Point South, and I started brokering, competing against my old company, which I didn't like the sound of that or the taste of that, but it just is reality. And earned more. I did $1 million in revenue the first year, and I got to keep 100% of it versus $100,000 in a W-2 with the gym membership to the YMCA and a paid cell phone. I thought I was living large. And I had a good mentor who was kind enough to say, that's a 90-10 split. Because I was doing $1 million in revenue at Rock. And they're like, that's a 90-10 split. Like, you need to wake up. You're worth more. And you need guys like that in your life. Matthew's surrounded by a lot of good guys. And Spencer, you and I don't know each other that well. But you need guys in your life to tell you, like, you're worth more than that. You can do more than that. Think bigger. because we tend to sometimes identify who we are and especially at an early age. And then that remains the box you think in.
Yep.
And it's all about breaking through that ceiling of complexity and breaking out, and the sky's the limit. And so that's really, that was a really high cliff for me to jump off of to start my own company. But that transitioned into more brokerage, started a Select My Space, which is an apartment finding company that I later sold to some guys in town that went to Harvard and Yale. I felt really smart selling to those guys. And you guys would know, I won't say their names, but and I started buying more properties because I had more income. And so it's about taking those steps, and it's not always easy, and it can be scary. So that was sort of early part of my career. And with Percadia, full open book, they know that I buy property. You know, I don't go right. plastered on my Facebook and Instagram, but they were cool with that.
One of the things you've done, and I'm interested, it's kind of a long question, but is you've gotten into other lines of business. Now, right now you're basically brokering deals and you're investing, but you said you started Select My Space, which was a apartment locator business. You also started a property management company. So talk about the difference between like getting into different verticals within kind of under the same umbrella versus staying focused on just one or two things, and how your mindset has changed over the years, whether you're still looking for ancillary businesses under the same umbrella. I'm just really curious how you think about that.
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, started Select My Space. Part of the reason why I started the new companies is because I get frustrated if things aren't done fast enough, or I call vacancy cancer. You know, it kills a property. If you don't have an occupied home or multifamily, you know, units, then the rest of it doesn't matter. I see property management and ownership as leasing, maintenance, accounting. You can call it what you want: marketing, customer service, accounting, reporting, right? It's three functions. We did Select My Space really well. We answered our phone between 11 and 1. We answered our phone after 5 during the weekdays. We answered our phone on the weekends. All the times that third-party managers on these particular properties in this area, 10, you know, 50 units and below, they didn't have on-site staff. All the times where their staff were not available. So we just grabbed their market share because that's when people were looking to rent. We saw a problem. We had a solution. That transpired into, okay, well, we're doing one well, and I have a heart for people, and I have a heart for people living in the homes. This is their home, and one of the top three reasons people rent is for maintenance. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. I don't want to do this. I got to work. I want to travel. I want to, whatever. Well, it's probably top five. Maintenance is in there. And I had this sort of white glove kind of, you know, put on the booties and like leave the note that I've been in here. I really wanted to create an experience for people. I was listening to a Tim Keller podcast, and it was about ministering to people in the city. And so I wanted to turn my career and apply my career and align that with my passions, my heart, my desire to be aligned with my overall mission and mission statement. So we started Blue Canoe Properties, and we grew to 80 properties in 3 years, and it was crazy. I mean, we were printing statements late at night, you know, like it was, I learned a lot. It's hard to make money in the property management business. It really is. It's a service business, and it takes rare people to do it. A mentor of mine came to me one day and said, "You need to sell both of those. You're taking off on brokerage. Like, hey man, wake up." So I sold Blue Canoe and I sold Select My Space. And once I get to enough scale with OG Capital, you know, right now we use third party managers. We have four that we use from Chattanooga to Mobile. Eventually, once we get enough units, and I'd say enough units means probably 2,000 to 5,000 units, that justifies having an in-house management team. That's probably in the cards in the future. But ancillary, man, Mike, Matt, I'm always thinking about stuff. We were in a meeting just before this call thinking about a software app that would be mind-blowing and very useful. So I'm always trying to find solutions in our industry that could be disruptors. And I'd love to hit one or two, you know, by the time I turn 60.
That's one of the things that I love about you is you're very visionary. You've always got unbelievable ideas. I was bouncing some ideas off you. I think it's probably been nine months ago about some things. But the other thing for people that are listening to this, David is sitting in a t-shirt. Can't tell if you're wearing jeans or shorts or whatever, but right before that you were out walking properties too. So you're still out hustling. You don't have people that are out doing that for you. You're actually physically out walking some properties. So tell us what a day in your life looks like, these days. I know every day is probably different, but.
Yeah, everything's different and everything's good. I love what I do, and it's fun to get up every morning because every day is different. And we have a great team. Like yesterday, I'll rewind. Yesterday, we picked our buyer for a listing we had at Mercadia, a 722-unit deal on Valley Avenue just here in Homewood. We picked a buyer yesterday at 80 plus million. I can't give the number, but 80 plus million. We had 15 offers north of 75 million. We dealt with the COVID, flying people in and out. We had a tremendous outcome and we picked our buyer. So that felt good to put that in the buyer's lap last night. Institutional capital behind the buyer. They have 6 billion under management. Quality sponsor and operator. This will be their first deal in Birmingham. So I worked really hard on that listing. It was probably a good 90-day busted, you know, grind, calling people, emailing, getting people, selling that deal. And then also yesterday I did a pitch on $80 to $100 million property and pitched for the listing. I brought in the mayor of Hoover because it's in Hoover and had him speak to the ownership, who are some highly influential people in the country, which you guys would know if I said their names. And we're hoping to win that listing. Meanwhile, I drive up to my lake house last night and I got up this morning to meet one of our renovation teams on two mobile homes that I bought on Smith Lake. Here's my lake house. These are the first mobile homes I've ever bought, and I've really kind of been fascinated with mobile homes, modular. I've studied it the last 5 years. And so these are two good lots, and I was like, all right, I'm going to rent these and play around with these and learn these things in and out. And the lots were worth what I paid, so the homes were just a bonus, and they're not in bad shape, so we're going to clean them up and rent them. And the name of the LLC is Win-Win LLC. Two trailers that are side by side, a mother-daughter. I had them. And so I came in this morning and met with Oakworth Capital Bank in this. Apologize a little bit. And then met with my OG Capital team, podcast with you guys, and I'm leaving here to go down 280 to a property we just listed. 100 Inverness is the name of that one. It's a $40 million deal. We're going to launch it September 8th, I believe, right after Labor Day. And we'll take that out to the market. We typically go out to about 10,000 people. We'll have signed CAs of about 200. We'll get 15 to 20 bids. We'll pick five and invest in final round, and then we'll pick one. It's usually a 30-day marketing period, and we try to do that 10 times a year. So Valora being one on Valley, 100 Inverness being two. We like to do that about 10 times a year. We call them weddings, buyer, seller, walk them down the aisle, marry them, music, flowers, do it again. Wedding planning.
We need to pick up some of his, some Davidisms.
Yeah, those are good.
Talk about why people choose Birmingham. I mean, you're flying people in from all over the country that are investing in Birmingham. What are they telling you that they're looking for, and why does Birmingham meet that?
Yeah, Birmingham's has always had a pretty high barrier to entry, just geographically with our hills, mountains, rock, municipalities, which have quite a have a high degree of NIMBYism, not in my backyard, Hoover, Homewood, Vestavia, Mountain Brook. They really don't care a lot about, you know, permitting new apartments. Hoover downgraded their zoning to 7 units an acre several years back. Very hard to make a deal work that way. Almost a moratorium, but not. Secondly, people love Birmingham because of the diversification of the job base. Historically, banking community, medical, high medical community, over 11, 12 hospitals in the metro area. Automotive has been tremendous because between Vance, just west of us, 30 miles, with Mercedes, Honda and Lincoln just east of us, and Hyundai south of us, and now Toyota Mazda north of us in Huntsville. A lot of those people who work in those plants, they live in Birmingham to take advantage of our school systems, because a 30-minute, a 20-minute, an hour drive commute means nothing to people who have lived in Atlanta, D.C., Raleigh, etc. So not a big issue. So we kind of have a really diverse job base. In times of recession, like in 08, we were like top 10 metros to bounce back from the 08 recession because of our of two things. Healthcare and education thrive in recessionary periods. Our aging population plays into that. And secondly, people go back to school when the job market is thin. And we're fortunate to have some great academic programs and schools here in Birmingham with UAB, Birmingham Southern, Samford, and then a whole host of other community colleges and trade schools.
I'd love you to expound on that. I mean, we're in a recession, and with
I feel like we think so.
So we're recording this on August 18th, 2020, and so we do have a lot of healthcare here. Talk about why you think Birmingham will thrive even through this kind of weird pandemic time we're in.
Yeah, I think our cost of living is still very low, and we see the in-migration trends continue to be consistent on the positive side for Birmingham. People are moving here to be around their kids who have chosen to live in Birmingham. Either they went to school here and they stay here. So retention rates are higher for people who go to school here. They plant here. That number has vastly increased in the last 10-year period. A lot of those same younger people were graduating and going to the Nashvilles, the Raleighs, the Charlestons, the Austin, Texas, Denvers, and Chattanooga. And we've seen a much higher retention rate there because job growth is better, jobs are cooler. We got our business community got together and said, let's launch some incubators, let's get higher tech. Let's get some breweries to have some things for them to do after work, right? Let's get less the region's ball field downtown. So we have more vibrancy in youth now in our ecosystem, which I think, and that's so now mom and dad, so family and household formation grows, then mom and dad want to be near the kids. It's a multiplier effect. And so cost of living, household formation, you know, overcrowd, you know, the cost of living in our competing cities like Nashville and Raleigh, they're much higher than that. That has gone up. Not to say that that hasn't happened in Birmingham, but I think it's a culmination of all those things. But sometimes people miss the underlying spirit of a deal. And in this case, it's the spirit of Birmingham. Like, you guys have felt it. I felt it. Like, leadership's better, like young mayor, like, you know, like leadership is stronger. People are stepping up.
People care.
The older population is sort of passing the baton, like, and they're writing checks to support, for example, UAB's football team. Meryl Stewart told me that he got in the room with the Drummonds and this and that and some high, you know, big families in Birmingham. And then within 15 minutes, they had raised the money to bring UAB's football team back on.
Wow.
So that's the kind of leadership I'm talking about. Just sort of that spirit of Birmingham that we don't always – like Chattanooga, I mean, like they have an incredible, like, spirit of the city. The arts, the colors, they support a wide range of people, and from local, you know, local municipalities get along, right? And change happens. And we're getting more and more of that thought pattern in Birmingham. And quite frankly, we have a little Huntsville envy, which I think is driving some of that fuel and fire, which I think is good. I think it's really good.
Yeah, nothing like having somebody out setting the pace, try to catch up with them to right. To get you motivated. So, you know, what does a client look like for you? Tell me what the ideal client is. You're obviously pitching some pretty big clients. Does your team also help buy the smaller deals, the 50-unit to 100-unit deals?
Absolutely, yeah. Good question. We still love doing small deals. I'd say that our cutoff's kind of, you know, 20, 30 units is kind of a minimum we like to do. And I've got some guys on my team that are really strong in that area and deal with more the smaller side private clients and new investors. So, you know, we could do a 20, 30 unit deal. We really like to walk with people and build their portfolio. And because I started there, so I have a lot of empathy and desire to see people achieve their goals. And I will never judge anybody. Because I did it once. I'll tell you about a mistake I made. A guy approached me once and came over from Atlanta. I won't say his name. And he said, "Hey, David, we should buy this management company together. I would like to start investing. I want to do 50-50 with you." And I said, "Well, cool. What's your track record?" He said, "Well, I own 4 condominiums in Destin, Florida." And I was like, "Scott, no." I just said no. Like, it was just like probably 2008 or 2009. And I said no, brushed it off. Like, I was totally egotistical about it and prideful. And today he has done probably close to $5-6 billion of acquisitions.
Goldman Sachs. Oh, gosh.
So I don't judge any of you watching. And the sky's the limit.
That's right. You got to start somewhere.
Got to start somewhere.
Well, this has been great, David. I think it's a good time to wrap it up. I appreciate your time. I know it's super valuable, and I appreciate your friendship and being able to call you up and ask questions. And you just give us some great advice and some really good feedback. So thank you so much for this time.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, David.
I think you guys are doing a good thing. And if anybody wants to know more about multifamily, we do have several smaller deals listed right now. And we can help you. We can help you with banking relationships, third-party managers. I'm talking to some good ones right here. And we'd be glad to help. So thanks for your time.
Now, what's your contact information, David, so they can reach out?
The best way to reach me is at my Bracadia email, to keep it simple, just david.oakley, O-A-K-L-E-Y, like the sunglasses, david.oakley@bracadia.com. That's B-E-R-K-A-D-I-A.com.